So, it's a great pleasure, Peter, after some years, to be back in Laird again and to have a chance to talk to Peter Burke, a very distinguished colleague and my first historian, anthropologist rather than anthropologist historian on this series. Peter, what I usually start with is ask people to talk about their families, their family background. I know you have a very interesting mixed parentage, so you can go back as far as you like, as long as you don't do a newer and go back eight generations, but just back to grandparents and that downwards, what they did, what they were like, what effects they had on them.
Fine, so I jump in and say that I'm the kind of Englishman, none of whose grandparents were born on this island, but two from the extreme west of Europe and two getting on for the extreme east of Europe. So two from Galway, arriving in England, typical time for Irish immigrants to come, I suppose, 1904. My father was born in Birkenhead a week after they arrived, to his eternal sorrow, because he would have loved really to have been born in Ireland. And the whole of his life he talked about the English as the English, which I'm sure has some funny consequences for my sense of identity, even though he didn't really go back very often. And then my mother's family, her father from Vilnius, I mean, he called himself a Russian, but that's because, after all, Vilnius was firmly part of Tsarist Russia. He would have left, let me think, he left in 1883. My grandmother, who came from Łódź, the Manchester of Poland, she left in 1887, and the earliest family document, I just found it again last week when clearing out, is her French grammar. She has a grammar, French-Polish, but the Polish is written in Cyrillic. And it's an interesting document of one particular moment in the history of East Europe. And clearly, the Russian, Lithuanian, and Polish parts of the family wisely chose to come out in the 1880s, because that was the time of the pogroms. And therefore, that's right. Completely, as far as I know. So I'm a mestizo. By Jewish tradition, I'm Jewish because my mother's Jewish. And by Catholic tradition, I'm Catholic because my father's Catholic. And in any case, my mother was converted. I never knew how deeply, but in order to get married to my father, she was perfectly happy to do this. And then she was in the funny situation of having to bring me up as a Catholic during the war when he was away, because he spent the war in Italy and Egypt. And maybe she didn't do it with great fervour. I mean, she did it absolutely as she was supposed to. But I found giving up Catholicism was absolutely no problem. I mean, I never had a deep, that sort of deep emotional attachment to it. I'm fond of Catholic culture. And the bizarre thing is, when I went to Poland for the first time, not till 1964, so then it's Eastern Europe and it's Catholicism. It's nothing to do with my background in a sense, but it's a way of joining my halves, and I felt tremendously at home in Catholic Poland, despite, of course, its tradition of anti-Semitism isn't even dead. I went in 64. In 69, you could read in the newspapers, General Mochar and his fascists, they were still persecuting Jewish academics and others.
What languages did your parents speak? Because you're a very good linguist. Did you get anything from your
parents? To me, they only spoke English, but they met at a German club. I mean, so it was an interest in learning German that led to them meeting one another in London, something called the Deutsche Verein, which must have been flourishing in the late 20s in London. And my mother must have had very good German once, because she spent a year in Berlin, 1930 to 31, so late Weimar, and was always very enthusiastic about that. But went back only once after 33, couldn't bear the atmosphere, and never went back. My father was a real linguist. I mean, never formally, not more than Latin and Greek and French at school, same as me. But he became a professional translator, mainly French and German, in a British American tobacco company, which was boring, but it was languages. But he learned languages as a hobby. And his proudest moment was he was once introduced at a party as the man who'd forgotten 20 languages. That was the sort of compliment he really was pleased to be given. And he tried everything. I mean, the war, he was in Cairo, so he started Arabic. And then they sent him to Caserta, he started Italian. And when he was a bookseller, which is what he became later on, I remember him learning to read Chinese and above all Japanese so that he could sell Japanese prints, things like that. So, yes, I have, in that sense, carried on a family tradition. But no Irish. I don't think even my grandparents would have learned more than 20 or 30 words of Irish because they were before the real age of linguistic nationalism. I mean, I'm sure they believed in home rule, but I don't think they thought that you needed to learn this language, even in the West. You know, in Galway, you still can't get a job in University College Galway without Irish. I once saw a job advert, even at a time when I was interested in jobs in history, and it said, please send 40 copies of the application and bear in mind that the interview will be in Irish. So I didn't apply.
There must be one of the few languages you don't speak, Peter. Which languages do you speak fairly and reasonably?
Romance languages. Even then, not quite all of them. I mean, I started Romanian as well, but no, French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, and a bit of Catalan, and all of them like that character in Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose, remember Salvatore, because he speaks a total mix of the Romance languages. If I don't speak a total mix, I don't think I can utter more than two or three sentences in any one of them without contamination from one of the others. Like I go to Italy and give a lecture now, and instead of saying come, I say como. And afterwards people say, why did you do that? And it's too similar, it interferes.
What about reading? You can read all these languages.
I read the Germanic languages, just about all of them, and I can decipher certain Slav languages. I really made the effort with Polish, and partly, I suppose, because of my grandmother, and partly because wanting to work on 17th century history, Polish is much more relevant than Russian. I mean, Muscovy really was on the edge of Europe, but Poland was a great power making a big impact on the rest of Europe. And I said to myself, when I finish Polish, I'll start Russian. But then I never finished Polish. I got stuck in it somehow. But it has been great fun, and it's still useful. I can pick up a book, I know exactly what it's about. I can't be sure always what the author's saying, but then of course it's not a problem in Cambridge to find somebody who can give you the translation of just the paragraph that you know you really want.
To return to your parents, can you say something about their characters and the way that you think they may have influenced you?
That's not so easy. My mother, definitely more extrovert, more outgoing, would have liked to have much more social life. But she was a different person in the nuclear family, and when she was telephoning her sisters, which since she did in the house, I mean, it struck me already as a small child that when she got onto the telephone to one of her four sisters, she became a different person, much more continental. She started to gesture, she spoke much more loudly, and all sorts of Yiddish words appeared, which she never used otherwise except in front of my grandparents. So I was aware that there was this language, and I suppose I still know about 20 words of it, but she never spoke it in front of my father. And my father was much more of a solitary person. I mean, he made a few friends, but he said very few people he would cross the road for if he saw them on the other side. He didn't really want people to come home to dinner and so on. He liked just to be with us, and his hobby was reading by himself. I think I have inherited a bit of that. I mean, I like to alternate periods of sociability and periods of being by myself. And I can't manage without both. I don't think I can think without being by myself. But in order to think the right thoughts by myself, I need to have been in intense conversation with other people maybe an hour before. So I suppose, yes, I hadn't really thought about this from the character side. But yes, I'm sure I owe quite a lot to both of them.
And returning to your schooling,
yeah.
You went to a Jesuit school.
That's right. But only St. Ignatius, Stamford Hill, which was the grammar school, so I started at 11, and they had me at the prep school from 9. But of course the Jesuits used to say, famously, give me a boy at the age of 7, and you know, I'll make him into what the order wants, what God wants. And so they missed out on me by 2 years. And indeed, when we were 16, there was one of these Jesuit retreats, compulsory for all of us, which was just like the part of Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, complete with the Hellfire Sermon. I mean, when I read Joyce a year or two later, I just had that sense it was a rerun of my own life, because his Jesuit school, Clongowes Wood, it was more fashionable than mine, but absolutely the same tradition. But I can remember they told us all, pray to have a vocation to the priesthood. But they couldn't hear us. I prayed not to have a vocation to the priesthood. So, and those.
Would you say at any time you really were deeply believing in the presence of a God, or were you always sceptical? You've done a lot of work on sceptics.
Yes,
and
yes.
And so on.
I found the sceptical position to be attractive for a very long time, definitely in the sixth form. Mm. I mean, I really enjoyed finding objections to, because the Jesuits, like intellectual Catholics, wanted to demonstrate the existence of God. And we did Aquinas as the truth, not as history of philosophy. So I still probably know the five ways to prove the existence of God by heart. But of course I couldn't resist making objections. And they enjoyed this. I mean, maybe if it's the Benedictines or the Dominicans, they would disapprove of this. But the Jesuits, they think this is playing the game. And then they would find answers to my objections and we would enjoy ourselves. I think they always thought they'd win me over in the end, but I don't know. It was quite fun having this, and it went on into Oxford, where I tried formally to leave the church and was instantly visited by Jesuits whom the Catholic chaplain himself, no intellectual, very charming upper-class Englishman, Monsignor Elwes, straight out of Evelyn Waugh, absolutely perfect specimen. And so he told one Jesuit and one secular priest to come and see me. A very smooth Jesuit called Joe Christie, I never saw him again. And a very serious, very small, very intense secular priest. And the first thing he said as we went for a walk along the river to talk about religion, I could be in your position next year. And he was called Anthony Kenny, and he's better known as the Master of Balliol, having left the priesthood not so many years after we had these conversations.
Was there anyone at school, any teacher, who particularly influenced you? Sometimes there are one or more people who...
I don't think, but I ought to say that I had a history master who really did have ambitions for me. I suppose I don't think he had a big influence, because I woke up one morning when I was 7 and said to my mother, I'm going to be a professor of history. Mm. I'm not sure what I thought being a professor of history meant. I'd heard of lectures. Mm. I had absolutely no idea, of course, what a university was like. Mm. So in that sense, I mean, I was sure I wanted to be a historian. But Father O'Higgins he put a lot of effort into making sure I did well at A level and S level. And there were only 3 of us in the class, and finally for S level I was the only person there. And then he went, they took him out of teaching and sent him to Campion Hall, and for years he was a sort of research fellow there. Good, but not all that good. I mean, good to one, he did a very decent monograph about the English Enlightenment. But he was serious about history, and so maybe seeing for the first time somebody who was serious in that way could have influenced me more than I ever thought at the time.
You took history as your entrance for Oxford.
That's right. Yeah, so A-level was history, French, and English, history, Latin. I wanted French, but it was on at the same time as Latin or something. So that concession had to be made. Though I never regret having read a lot of English literature and criticism and written essays about John Donne in the sixth form. But yeah, so I did the open scholarship at St. John's in history. It seems, I can't quite believe it, 60 years ago this year. And of course that old-fashioned way that you went and lived in the college for 3 years.
It can't be 60.
Well, 1954, but it would have been December. That's right.
It's 50 years.
1954, because... Oh, you're right. So, that's right. I'm going to sleep. Yes.
As a child prodigy. No. Six.
17 and 3 months. The interviewers demanded to know how many months. They were quite interested by that sort of thing.
50 years ago. And you got an open scholarship.
Yes. I mean, I didn't expect to because nobody from my school had done this. And you know how it is. There are 100 or 200 students living in the college like undergraduates for 3 days. And I remember sitting at dinner next to this incredibly confident public school boy, and he was telling me all about how the system worked. And I thought, and I had no idea, so I thought he would get in and I wouldn't. And of course I got a scholarship and he was never seen again. And afterwards I thought, well, why did he know so much about it? He'd probably done this thing three times because he'd failed twice. But
were you at that time interviewed by Keith Thomas?
No. So this in 54, this was run by Costin, who had given up history to be the senior tutor and was going to go on to be the president of St. John's just as I got there. And a terribly shy, young-looking man, not quite as young as he looked, Howard Colvin, who taught me medieval history while really wanting not to do that, but the history of architecture, which finally they let him do. And of course, he had a second distinguished career, which I think he's still engaged in writing about the history of 17th, 18th century English architecture.
So you got the open scholarship, but before you could take it up, you were enlisted into the Great British Army.
That's right, because they actually said to me at the interview, what would you say if we offered you a scholarship on condition that you did the national service first? And I said instantly, apply to Cambridge. And then afterwards, the senior tutor wrote me this letter, which my father saw about, right, we won't make this a legal requirement, but I must insist that the wisest thing for you at this stage is to do the army. And so I did. And it was the wrong moment in the year because I had a clear idea, if I'm going to be in the army, I want to do the Russian course and I want to be sent to Germany. And then I go to Oxford with two languages that I'd like to know and don't know a word of. But I was going in September. So that means that people who had read modern languages all over the country were doing their deferred national service and wanting to do this and had better qualifications than me. So I missed out on all that, and they decided to make a clerk of me. So I did basic training in Catterick, which was horrible but illuminating. It took me about 20 years to realise what the point was of some of the things that they made us do. I thought of it again about after seeing the videos of what was happening in Iraq a few weeks ago. Because actually, yes, I think this is very interesting. In the barracks, they were very keen on polishing boots. And we were told that we had to appear on parade the next day with very brightly polished boots. We were issued with boots which were totally unpolished. We were then told informally that there's only one way to get the high polish. You burn it on with a spoon. You heat a spoon in the candle, you apply it to the black polish, and it burns in. It destroys the waterproofing, and it's forbidden. So we were simultaneously told, get this result, but the only means is forbidden. And so obviously, we all did it, and we all said we didn't do it. And I thought, this is totally absurd. I'm living in a kind of Dadaist world, And years later, I thought that maybe when the officer tells people, be gentle with the prisoners, but just get them to talk, somehow people would have learned the lesson. And then I had clerk's training, and then I got posted, but this was the good fortune, to Singapore to be the pay clerk, and to be the pay clerk in a local, in a regiment of what the army called in its bureaucracies, locally enlisted personnel, which meant Malays, meant Chinese, meant Indians, mainly Tamils, meant Anglo-Indians in the sense of mestizos, one Filipino that I can remember. Anyway, it was a wonderful ethnic mix, and the British characteristically only trusted the British with money, so they needed not only the pay captain but the pay corporal to be English, although we were assisted by Chinese clerks in the office. But I was the one that had to go to the bank with the pay captain to draw the regiment's weekly wages. This was great fun, because it meant you went into the Hong Kong and Shanghai bank carrying a loaded Sten gun. Actually, I didn't enjoy it as much as I should have done, because I spent my time worrying about whether the magazine would fall out, because I'm not terribly good at putting these things together, whether I'd disgrace myself. But I did notice when you got in with a loaded Sten gun, you got to the front of the queue very fast.
You might have become a bank robber after that experience.
That's right, but I'd still have been worrying about what was going to happen to the magazine. And that's when I really effectively was doing something like field work without knowing. I mean, I think until I was 21, I had not come across the word anthropology. Mm. Then I picked up a book by Evans Pritchard, not one of the famous ones, but a little introduction to the subject. And as I began to read his description of field work, it suddenly clicked with me. It's what I had really been doing for more than 18 months in Singapore District Signal Regiment, because there wasn't much else for me to do. I had a boring job that didn't take very long to do. And this fascinating mixture of people who looked different, who spoke differently, who had very different customs. And I wanted to observe it and write it down in a notebook. I mean, it was a real culture shock. But the really shocking bit of the shock was, I think, in the first week, when I realised how corrupt the regiment was. I mean, I come straight from school. I wasn't used to things not working according to the rules. And the officers didn't see anything, because in the hours that they were in the regiment, everything worked in the way that it was supposed to work. But they went home, or to the officers' mess, 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and they didn't come back till 8 o'clock the next morning. And the regiment was dramatically transformed, and there were so few British other ranks, as they called us, that nobody put on any theatre in front of us. So, right, the stores. The quartermaster sergeant, I don't, somehow faked the books, so that large quantities of equipment ended up in a market in town, which was known unofficially as the thieves' market. And if you lost a piece of equipment, you always replaced it there for a third of the price, rather than the official price. The drivers used to siphon the petrol out of the tank of the lorries and sell it, and they managed to fake the routes. The biggest, several friends of mine were engaged in a protection racket, so that the local Chinese restaurant was paying them a weekly sum not to have the windows smashed in. But the best of all of these things was this tremendously dignified and elderly Indian whose day job was delivering tea to the offices, which he did very well with his kind of staff. And his night job, he simply rented out space in the regiment for civilians to sleep. And they had to be gone by 6 in the morning so that they were invisible to the authorities. I can't imagine how much rent he was getting in this way, or how many years it went on. So I suddenly realised I'm in a totally different world in these ways, not just the fact that people are all these different colours. And the first day of arrival, all the British new arrivals, maybe 6 of us, we were called in front of the CO. And he made a little speech, sermon really, which he must have done a lot of times. And he said, "These are not black bastards, they are your brown brothers." And in fact, there'd just been a scandalous incident, I think, 2 weeks before we arrived, a kind of very small race riot, because one of the Malays was playing the piano too loudly in the Malay Nafi for the liking of one of the English. So he went to the kitchen, helped himself to a slice of bacon, went and smeared it on the piano keys, thus effectively stopping piano playing for the evening. But of course there was a complaint, and the CO had to sort it all out, and then he added this thing to his speech. Oh, and he even told us, this was real preparation for anthropology. So almost the only thing that he told us about life in the regiment, don't offer anybody anything with your left hand, don't accept anything with your left hand because the Malays think it's unclean. And it's a regiment with 4 cookhouses. So, and I was terribly tempted by the Malay one. I mean, obviously walking past and smelling the cookhouses. And then I realised, of course, there'd be no knife and fork in there. And there are all the Malays elegantly eating their rice and curry with one hand. And I think to myself, how many months would it take me to learn to do that? Would I ever learn to do that? And the only time I saw that again was in Berlin, because I was there the same year as André Bété, and his daughters came, and his wife just once to see him. And because we'd become friends, he invited me and Maria Lucia to dinner. And the daughters ate again with great elegance with their hands, while the parents ate with us with a knife and fork. So that was my one big regret, that I wasn't physically adaptable enough. I would love to have done it. The Malays would have found it great fun. I mean, they enjoyed having an Englishman asking about their customs all the time. Kept asking me if I was going to turn Muslim. Especially the day that I came with a souvenir. I bought one of these green velvet sonkos and came back with it in a box which revealed to everybody as I passed the guardroom what I was carrying. And so they started to make jokes about, was I going to turn up at the mosque next Friday?
Do you think all this experience, I mean, in the sense you've answered it, but led into the fact that you are one of the few historians who really seriously read in anthropology and applied anthropology to your work and been interested in popular culture and so on? Was it this experience, do you think, that...
It's what I now think. I mean, I didn't think about this at the time. I picked up an anthropology book, was instantly fascinated, started to read more without stopping to ask myself, why am I so interested? But then thinking back, the books were describing situations which were recognisably like what I'd just been doing in Singapore. Well, not just. I mean, I was 5 years earlier in Singapore. So I started not with any kind of high theory, but I started reading a plain ethnography and found it quite fascinating. And the thought even crossed my mind, would it be fun to read anthropology at Oxford afterwards? And if so, I was sure I would do field work in either in Kelantan or Terengganu, because I found the Malays such charming people. I'd visited these villages. I'd realised they're very hospitable. It would have been great fun to do field work in a place where it's very easy to have... I mean, I had very easy rapport with all the Malays that I met. There were about 400 of them in the regiment. I went through all their files. Almost everybody had one of two jobs, rubber tapper, paddy planter, and joined the army when things were going badly. And when I complained about the food, I remember somebody saying to me, "We've never had 3 meals a day before. Why are you complaining?" They thought the food in the army was absolutely wonderful.
Well, perhaps we now ought to get back to Oxford.
Yes.
After this liberating experience, you then went to Oxford to read history.
That's it. The first week, I have to say, I went to see the senior tutor and said, "I want to do Chinese." And he said, if so, you'll lose your scholarship. So I thought no more of it, but it would have been a temptation. So I might have had a career, in fact, like Jonathan Spence, who's a year older than me and went to Cambridge and did history, or Mark Elvin, who was at Oxford not long after me. But anyway, the next thing was, they said, do you want to do medieval history? And I said, but for some reason at that point I decided, no, early modern.
At that time you had to do all history, I mean.
You had to do English 1, 2 and yes. 3, yeah. but what they delightfully called foreign history, you could choose one of 8 periods.
Yes.
And I think Howard Colvin expected me to do the late Middle Ages, and in fact I did 16th, 17th centuries. And that meant, because this new young tutor had come to the college, I think he arrived a week before me from All Souls, Keith Thomas, it meant that he tutored me for European history as well as for English too.
Well, Keith is going to loom large at some point, so...
That's right.
Perhaps now we...
This is the cue.
This is the cue. I mean, he was my DPhil supervisor too, and I only met him at the end of my undergraduate career. What was it like as an undergraduate teacher and later on in influence?
So starting with 1958, he was quite shy. He was extremely earnest. There was no sign of the later famous irony. And I remember first that him telling everybody, history has become terribly professional. I mean, he wanted everybody to work really hard. He encountered some resistance because half my year had been in the army for 2 years. And they got used to not engaging in a lot of intellectual activity. And so that, and the other thing, I think he had a very interesting way of giving every essay a social twist in the tutorial. So he would set a perfectly conventional political history question, which we might then, from the book list, be inspired to give a very conventional political history answer, which up to a point is what he wanted, but in the last 10 or 15 minutes he would open the thing up by saying, but you could look at it this other way too. And it wasn't in the books and articles. And then I later started to think, this is probably Christopher Hill. I think when I began giving tutorials, because Sussex began with a tutorials system with 2 students at a time, of course, I'd never done it before. How do you do it? You do it by imitating your own tutors. So the first year I spoke like Keith, and now I'm guessing that his first year he spoke like Christopher. Though Maria Lucia's interviews contradict this, because Keith now claims, I don't know with what plausibility, that Christopher never said a word in...
Well, several of the interviewees say the same thing. About 3 or 4 of them say the same thing.
Very intriguing that
Maybe
he could... Yeah, got away with saying absolutely nothing. Yeah.
That's right, nor suggesting anything.
Yeah. And then there's the later Keith. So when I was a graduate student and a kind of a restive, critical graduate student of the kind that was making a noise about what was wrong with both the undergraduate system and the graduate system. And Keith had just become the editor of the Oxford Magazine and asked me to write about it and so on. And we also organised a few talks about history and something. And Asa Briggs came and did history and sociology. And of course Keith did history and anthropology. And that was an oral presentation of what would about 2 years later be the past and present history and anthropology article. Wow. So that meant I did know, while I was still a graduate student at St. Anthony's, that Keith's interests had gone that way. But what had impressed us as undergraduates was the article in the Journal of the History of Ideas. The Double Standard.
Oh, yes.
So suddenly there was a sort of whispering campaign. it went through the 3 years of undergraduate historians that our tutor, whom we thought of as much more conventional than that, had published an article about men's attitudes to women and all this kind of thing. And in this funny journal, Journal of the History of Ideas, didn't know that was a kind of history, nothing to do with our book lists, because, and this was true of Keith for many years later, I mean, he would go on setting conventional history questions and giving people conventional history book lists while cultivating a kind of history that was very different, if not at odds with it. I have never compartmentalized in this way, but interestingly, for whatever reason, and I still am not sure I know, Keith has preferred for a long time to teach in one way and research in another.
How would you, and we don't need to use this, but yeah, you are one of the great historiographers of history, and if you had to place him, obviously there's still many things he may produce, but if you had to place him in the ranks of historians, thinking of the great historians you've written about, Lefebvre and Bloch and Brodel and others, you've got, yes, Trevor Roper and so on, where would you place him?
His style is much closer to Bloch than the others, because the others were all flamboyant. They even exaggerated what made them different from conventional historians. Bloch preferred understatement. He did it without making so much a fuss about it. Keith briefly made a fuss about it, partly, I think he was asked to write that article for Past and Present, and then he was asked to write the still more notorious article for the Times Literary Supplement about the new models and methods, which I know annoyed Geoffrey Elton so much. And after that, and maybe as a result of the flack that he got on those occasions, then he decided he was quietly going to renew history, but not make a song and dance about doing it. So that is very much the Bloch style. Say, in Le Roi Thaumaturge, it's one of the most innovative works of history published anywhere in the 20th century. But it does not begin with any kind of manifesto, whereas Lucien Febvre was always writing and rewriting manifestos. He also delivered the goods with the great Rabelais book and others. So I'm not saying that he wasn't a real innovator. And then Trevor Roper was flamboyant in another way, not in the sense of saying that he wanted to write a new kind of history. Though he was always sympathetic to Anaal, and he always had a European vision. But he liked to be flamboyant in his denunciations of his colleagues. Keith prefers the question, what do you think of X? And then very quietly, you know, I do think some of his or her work's a bit overrated. No more than that. But Trevor Roper, who was my research supervisor, and therefore whom I heard a lot of, I think that's the best way to put it, because we didn't have real conversations, but he talked at me a lot. And it was just like his public performances. It was always denouncing people. Actually, it is such a funny story of how I came to have Trevor Roper as a research supervisor that I think that ought to go on record as well. Because at that point, the Regius Professor used to interview anybody that wanted to do historical research, which meant almost entirely in the history faculty in Oxford in 1960, meant you signed on immediately for a PhD. There was very little interest in doing anything in between. And so I turned up and he said, what did you want to do? And I said I had a couple of early modern European topics in mind, one of which was the Jesuits. And then he said, got any supervisor in mind? And I said, yes, Anne Whiteman. He said something to her disadvantage. And then I said, well, maybe John Stoy. He said something to his disadvantage. And at that point, two simultaneous thoughts occurred. One is, I could go through the whole history faculty, and this man would then say something bad about everybody. And simultaneously, for some reason, he wants me to ask him to do it. So then I just said, well, if you're interested. And the next moment I found he was my supervisor. And that meant I saw him every term, and he walked up and down the room delivering a lecture. I mean, it may or may not have been a real lecture for the day after, but, you know, was it Queen Victoria complained about Mr. Gladstone? Mm. He addresses me like a public meeting.
Yes.
This was Trevor Roper, exactly. The whole rhetorical works, and he never looked at me. I think he always had a problem with most people. Maybe there were a few people who escaped from this. He couldn't easily relate to them. He had relatively few friends. He had a few disciples. And I never wanted to be a disciple, so at some point, after him treating me in a very friendly way as the patron, and I was getting a bit restive with that role and wanted to convert it to something a bit more egalitarian, but no, there was no space for that, and so we just drifted apart.
Was that after you finished your PhD?
Well, I never finished the PhD.
No, right. But so, at what point, you better keep your hands just to the side there.
We stayed quite close until after I'd published an essay about Tacitism, in which, in what was basically commissioned as an article on the history of the enthusiasm for Tacitus in the 16th and 17th centuries and its influence on historical writing, I couldn't resist saying that I thought The Last Days of Hitler was written in the Tacitist tradition. Of course, Trevor Roper was an ex-classic and so on. And he loved that, and at that point he was still regarding me as a good disciple. And a year or two later, I suspected he discovered I'd got involved with History Workshop, and that was the end. Because, there will be a point for this fairly soon, meeting Raphael Samuel was one of the great formative experiences for me after meeting Keith, after meeting Trevor Roper, after meeting Arnaldo Momigliano, to whom Trevor Roper gave me an introduction, but to whom I became much closer than to Trevor Roper.
Let's finish on those two then.
Yes.
I mean, if you had to put people into football divisions,
yes,
and the first division consisted of, for me, first division of great historians would be Maitland, maybe, there's not a historian, but these sort of great universal thinkers, Tocqueville, Maitland, Montesquieu, Montaigne, these sort of people.
Yes.
Then the top of the next division are R.H. Tawney, Namier, these sort of people. Mm. And then there's a, so to speak, a division below that. Where would you place Keith? I mean, would you say he was in the kind of Namier, Tawney?
I put Namier well above Tawney, though I think Tawney must have been a very much more sympathetic person than Namier. And so I think I would put Keith above Tawney, but well below Namier. I think Tawney, who wrote like an angel, but was not any kind of real innovator historically. I think Namier made a major breakthrough. Keith had certainly made a breakthrough.
Yeah.
But for sheer intellectual power, that's a different class, where I think of Trevor Roper maybe a tiny bit ahead of Keith, not a lot, but then the most intelligent people I've ever spoken to in my life, isn't it funny, two of them are more philosophers than historians. Isaiah Berlin, with whom unfortunately I never got on all that well, though I'd have liked to have done, but he didn't seem to approve of me more than, because he understood what you were saying before you got more, you got three words out, and he would answer it. You never finished sentences because there was no need, so you could cover a lot of ground very fast. And Momigliano could do that, though he always talked about only what was on his mind, and you had to laugh or pant to keep up because suddenly he bowled you a question about Thucydides and you didn't want to seem stupid, and because you wanted to go on talking to him. And desperately you had to say something about Thucydides to keep the thing going. And the third one was Leszek Kołakowski, whom I've met very rarely, but again, there was that sense that you didn't really need words to communicate.
We'll be making a transcript of this, so for Sarah's benefit, can you spell his his name?
Yes, that's so first name, which is the Polish for Leslie, L-E-S-Z-E-K, and then it's K-O-L with a stroke through.
K-O-L.
Yes. I'm so delighted now that I've gone from Macintosh to PC, because when you insert symbol, you can actually now spell Polish names properly with this special L character, which is pronounced W. As you notice, I said my grandmother came from a place that looks on the map like Lodz, but it's Łódź, because the L's got a stroke through and the O's got an acute accent on it.
I'll get you to spell his name afterwards.
Fine.
Okay. So, Momeliano, you said he influenced you, and you were fond of him.
Yes.
Can you say anything more about his work
and yes.
his influence on you?
So maybe one sentence as a prologue to that is that I had meant to do research on the Jesuits in the Jesuit archives in Rome. And I thought I'd set up this rather well, because I realised that you don't just, a PhD student doesn't simply write to the archivist of the Jesuits, not in 1960 anyway, without an intermediary. So I went to Campion Hall, and Campion Hall produced a Spanish Jesuit, whom I later met, a very gifted historian, Catalan, called Batliori, and he wrote a letter to the archivist, and then said I wrote, but even then it wasn't good enough, and I got a letter back in slightly wooden English saying, "Father archivist was not happy with my going to the archive for making thesis of doctorate." And I didn't really. He was an Italian. I didn't know Italy. I mean, I'd been to Italy twice at this point, but I didn't know Italian culture. I misread the letter, because it was really an invitation to negotiate. It was saying no, but saying no gently, which means when you turn up on my doorstep, we'll have a cup of coffee and I'll end up letting you in. But of course, I didn't want to be paying my airfare to Rome to be turned away from the door of the archive, and I was too literal-minded. I was reading the letter as if it was from an archivist in Britain, where the rules are the rules and letters mean what they say, and I was going to work in a culture where the rules are not quite the rules and letters don't quite mean what they say, and I hadn't done the anthropology of Italy thoroughly enough, so I needed a second subject, and I went for the history of historical writing, which I was already extremely interested in. And I chose an anti-Jesuit, as it happened, not to punish them, but just because I thought this was a wonderful historian, a Venetian called Paolo Sarpi, whom I continue to believe is one of the great historians of the 17th century on a level with Lord Clarendon. Trevor Roebuck was there about the only, certainly the only person in Oxford, and maybe the only the person in England at that time who would have known who Sarpi was and shared my particular enthusiasm. He'd read the history of the Council of Trent. So in that sense, he was the right supervisor, even if he wouldn't talk to me about what I was working on. And that meant historiography, because I realized, I mean, Trevor Roper didn't think of it, I thought of it, that if you didn't study the reception of the ancient historians in the 16th and 17th centuries, then you wouldn't understand what the great historians of the time were doing. So I thought, who are the most read historians in 16th, 17th century Europe? Livy, Tacitus, Sallust, maybe Polybius. Thucydides, unfortunately, a bit lower down on the list. So I've got to study the translations, and that's part of the background. And Sarpi's a Tacitist. And so when Trevor Roper saw I was starting to go in that way, he said, "There's somebody in London you absolutely have to meet, and this is Momeliano." So I went to see Momeliano, and we chatted, and we stayed in touch. You know, I took a liking to him, he took a liking to me. He was doing a lot of work at that time on the reception of the ancient historians, especially Tacitus. And we stayed in touch to the end of his life. And I bumped into him. It wasn't really, it was like continuing a conversation, the same conversation for 20 years. And he always assumed that you knew everything about whatever was in his head at a particular moment, which wasn't always true, but we communicated enough. And I think maybe he's the greatest scholar that I've ever encountered, which is not quite the same thing as the most intelligent intellectual or maybe even the most innovative historian. I think all these categories are a little bit different. But anyway, I did find him immensely impressive. And of course, I met Mom, as everyone calls him, at the height of his powers. The problem with Keith is I met him when he was young and shy and unknown. It took me time to adjust to his becoming a great man. I think maybe I was even a little bit late to recognize that when the book came out in 71 and I reviewed it on the radio, I realized it was in the class of Lawrence Stone's Crisis of the Aristocracy and Edward Thompson's Making of the Working Class. I mean, the three big fat books which British historians had been producing since 1960. I still hold by that judgment.
Well, you've mentioned two other people there.
Yeah.
Edward Thompson.
Yes.
And Lawrence Stone. Is there anything that did you know either of them well, or did they influence you beyond reading their books?
Lawrence, definitely, because he was lecturing at Oxford, and Christopher Hill and Lawrence Stone were the lecturers at Oxford for early modernists. You know, I never missed one. Stone, very histrionic, very self-dramatizing, whereas Edward Thompson, it was somebody whose books I read and whom I never met, I think this is right, until that conference you organized and this famous occasion where he said, "I'm a Marxist empiricist," and Ernest said, "Rubbish, it's a contradiction in terms." So I did meet him a few other times and would love to have known him better, though he was a difficult character. He was a fascinating character, could clearly be very charming. I saw him being very charming, and I heard about him being very difficult. Lawrence I kept up with, and it was thanks to him that I got to Princeton, because, of course, he went to that chair in Princeton. Trevor Roper characteristically commented to me, the appropriately named Dodge Chair of History. And then Lawrence obviously talked to people in the Institute of Advanced Study, and there was Felix Gilbert, this very gifted German emigre historian who lived two intellectual lives. So he wrote about the Italian Renaissance very well, but he wrote about 20th century Europe, especially Germany. And he had a chair at the Institute. And I think he must have said to Lawrence he was looking for younger scholars to go to the Institute. It was full of old men, basically. And Lawrence mentioned my name. But then I had to get references. And, of course, I had to get a reference from Trevor Roper. And I got such a funny letter back, he said. "I suppose you know that Lawrence Stone is in Princeton. I do not know whether that would be an incentive to you or not." So I wrote back and said, "I'm applying to the Institute. The person at the Institute is Erwin Panofsky, because I'm writing a book on the Renaissance, and Panofsky is the most important person in the world for me to meet." So I got the reference. But I got a sense of a certain cooling suspicion, because he guessed absolutely rightly that Lawrence had something to do with it. And when I went to Princeton, I used to shuttle between the Institute and the library, in the Firestone Library, where I was doing the research, and the History Department, where there were tremendous graduate seminars. I think the first week I was in Princeton, Tom Kuhn came to talk to the graduate students in history. And there was something like that every week, and the best tradition of the American style graduate seminar. So that was an education. Edward Thompson, it was an intellectual influence, because like so many people in the early 60s, especially Oxford historians that were interested in any kind of history that wasn't political. I was very interested in Marx and very sympathetic to Marx, though no kind of ist. I spent a lot of time at St. Anthony's reading Marx and Weber. Yeah, that was another education. Maybe it's not only people that influence you, it's environments. Right, so St. John's, Oxford was a great environment for relatively conventional history and the Oxford History Faculty at that point. But it wasn't such a good idea, I think, to do research in your own old undergraduate college, because middle common rooms at this point, 1960, were only just starting up. I thought I'd have the sensation, if I stayed at St. John's, of outstaying my time. You know, my friends had gone down and that sort of thing. Anyway, it was good to be funded. And Keith said, why don't you try St. Anthony's, because they've got those senior scholarships. They give you another 100 a year, which in those days really made a difference. And so I found myself in this college where most people were studying the 20th century and very few people came from Britain. In fact, there was even a division in the college fellowship. What should St. Anthony's do? And James Joll at that point had the idea, first of all, however strong the emphasis on the 20th century, it should always be complemented by having a few people in the college with other interests. Let's be a bit like those more rounded older colleges. And secondly, although it's absolutely right to have all these people from outside, let's take in 3 or 4 Oxford graduates every year, if only so that they can explain British culture and Oxford culture to people who have just appeared from Budapest, Tel Aviv, Dar es Salaam, and Tokyo. And that environment was very important to me. My best friend was an Ecuadorian. I'm still in touch with him so many years later. He got a job in Canada. And he had come straight from Paris, where he'd been a pupil of Pierre Chenu. So I had an intellectual interest in Anal. And then I was meeting somebody who was a foreigner on the fringe of the group. Very exciting. And the whole atmosphere, because it was a continental atmosphere in which people were not afraid to talk about philosophy over dinner. Not like St. John's, maybe like any Oxford college, maybe Worcester was like this. You didn't talk about this sort of thing at dinner. Maybe you went and had coffee in somebody's room and you had a serious conversation. But you ought to be just talking politely to your neighbour and not intensely about whatever the latest idea was. So St. Anthony's was a revelation that there's another speaking culture around. And I gravitated to Mediterranean or Latin people, of whom I count South Americans because of the Spanish tradition. So that environment was very important. Now, I forget how I went back to it for a reason which I've now forgotten. But maybe we could put brackets. Oh, yes, Marxism. So, of course, everybody else was into social theory, and I was reading Marx and Weber. And then I opened the lecture list, and there was a word in it I didn't understand, alienation. It looked very interesting. And this was a seminar, which also looked very interesting, because it was a joint sociology-philosophy seminar. Iris Murdoch, Norman Birnbaum. So I turned up, and, of course, Oxford seminars are different from Cambridge seminars, because Oxford seminars, there is the very great risk if you turn up in the first week that you'll be giving a paper later in the term, that they are now the two teachers announce the topic and give the introduction, and then they grab people in the audience and make them give papers. And I'm not very good at saying no to things, and by the fourth or fifth week I was giving a paper on the concept of alienation in the context of recent American sociological studies of factory workers, Norman Birnbaum providing the bibliography. I mean, that was the deal. You know, he gave you the reading, and then And I still, and this was actually a fascinating moment. I read a book, the author of which I forget, because it doesn't really matter. It was called The Man on the Assembly Line. Mm. And what was interesting to me wasn't what the sociologist said, but the long quotations from the interviews. Mm. So a worker says to him, "I don't like it here because they treat the men here like the machines." That kind of, and so I quoted this. Mm. And then at the end, Norman says, "Why did you choose that book? I gave you a choice of 6 books, and then you did a report entirely on one." And I said, "Because it was the only one where you heard the voices of the people that were being studied, rather than just the voice of the person studying." And I still remember a couple of people laughing, and Norman saying that, "You shouldn't laugh, because this is absolutely crucial in sociology." That the light's still on, by the way. You really have to listen to people talking. So, if you like, he had an ethnographic approach to sociology at a time when some sociologists were doing everything from questionnaires and statistics and so on.
So, in the ancestral lineage, Keith Thomas was your teacher, and Keith's teacher was Christopher Hill.
That's right.
Did you come across Christopher much?
Quite a bit. I mean, I asked him to talk to the College History Society. This is the typical way in which you get to know a leading historian in another college. Mm. And he was absolutely charming, and continued to see quite a bit of him on and off. He was invited to Sussex when I was at Sussex in the early days. When he became Master of Balliol, and I wrote a letter to congratulate him, he had a marvellous postcard that he sent me. He said he hoped that Brighton in the Broad would live up to the tradition of Balliol by the Sea. But I don't think I continued to get so much from him intellectually. I mean, I think as a Marxist, he was never as interesting as Eric Hobsbawm or Edward Thompson, because they were more creative with the concepts. He was a man deeply learned in 17th century England, who was also a Marxist, but he didn't develop his Marxism at all. It just stuck. And so it came to seem less interesting. So my admiration for him is above all as a person. I think he was a wonderful choice as Master of Balliol.
Both Christopher and Keith were in the tradition of what Trevor Roper described as thin trickles of text through lush meadows of footnotes. Mm. Not so much, but basically they were great quotas, yeah, of thousands of pamphlets and, yes, so on and so on. Did either of those people influence you in the way you actually wrote and studied history, by using quotations or not?
I don't think so. That is, I think there are so many historians before them who've used quotations effectively. Mm-hmm. And I never had a moment of sudden discovery that a few quotations together would tell a story very well, and you'd hardly need to intervene. Mm. And it's still a great challenge and a great pleasure to match the right quotations. I mean, I like quotations which bounce off one another, and each of them modifies your perception of the other one, and so the placing and so on. And I certainly have never gone in for footnotes on a Thomasian scale. Maybe that was the fault of my apprenticeship to Trevor Roper, who took these things much more lightly and used to make jokes about ponderous people and long footnotes. I mean, despite his admiration for Gibbon. But, so there I'm not so sure.
This is possibly a point to ask you about your writing methods.
Yeah.
I mean, do you, I've seen samples of your, yeah, writing, so I roughly know, but do you write with a typewriter, a computer? What's your traditional method, and how much do you change things and redraft?
Ever since 1985, I've written on the computer. I mean, as soon as I got one, I found that it was easier to write on the disk than it was to write on paper. And now I constantly revise. I mean, I like to pick up a subject, work on it, drop it for a week or two, do something else, come back to it. I like to drop a subject for years and come back to it. I'm working on a couple of articles now. One of them was a paper at Oxford in 1970. I never felt I'd got it quite right. On various occasions, I've taken it up again. Now, in memory of Roy Porter, I think I can actually send the thing off. So, definitely returning to things, elaborating things, occasionally dropping things, but usually just on another layer of encrustation. Mm. And before the computer, I was literally a scissors and paste person. Mm. So I typed, I typed it. Mm. And then I didn't like it, but I thought some of it I could use again, so I cut it up, and really I did have a big glue pot. Mm. But the problem with scissors and paste, you may remember, is you get it on the desk, and then so you have the bits of paper sticking to the desk, sticking to one another. And so the move to metaphorical cut and paste has been a real liberation for me.
And do you like writing?
Yes. Especially any draft after the first. Mm. And I also, and this goes back to school, sentences come in my head when I'm walking. And I always have to have a little notepad. It's very peculiar. Completely formed sentences emerge in the way that poems do for poets. Of course, I've got to write all the other sentences. Mm. But, the great thing is, read a book or be writing notes, do something intensely, then stop, go for a walk, and then the unconscious just does it and throws up the thing that, I don't know how long it would have taken me to find it, but I'm just given it. It's just great luck.
So do you regularly go for walks while you're working or break off? Or?
The best system of all that I've found is, yes, this is another curious thing. I think writing is a good start for research rather than the end product. Only when I start to write about something do I discover what I really need to know. So I say, write in the morning. That's thrown up a whole list of queries. Cambridge is wonderful for this. I walk to the university library. Walking to the university library, I stop two or three times because a sentence has come. In the library, I try to solve all the questions that came up in the morning. Next morning, insert these passages, rewrite, go on a bit, new questions, go back to the library the next afternoon. For me, it's an absolutely ideal system, with the most intense activity being the writing, and I'm freshest in the morning. Mm. And then I've got a bit more patience in the afternoon and don't to go through the books and let people tell me things in their own time, as authors will. Mm. And I don't work very much in the evening. Mm. It is funny, different people have very different rhythms.
Yes, that's excellent account. So, the other person or school which you're very much associated with is the Annales School in France. And how did you come in touch with them, and particularly with the work of Braudel?
Definitely while I was an undergraduate, I'd found Braudel's Méditerranée and read it and was already enthusiastic about it before I took schools. And I think Braudel was the first person where Keith used this famous technique. And I remember him saying, I think Braudel's rather overrated, don't you? And to this day, I cannot work out whether that was because he thought that, or whether he was trying me out, or what. But anyway, that fixes in my mind exactly when I was reading it. And then I went to other people from his footnotes, and I went back to Fabre, to whom the book was dedicated, and found that despite the over-flamboyant style for me, for most English people, he was saying really exciting things. And then, of course, Marc Bloch. And I therefore did think, as a graduate student, that it might be interesting to go and work with Braudel. But I never did. The Jesuits would have been okay because there's a piece in the Mediterranean where he talks about their role in the Philip II's takeover of Portugal. And I'd come across a book written in by a Portuguese Jesuit which managed to demonstrate the contrary. And I had always thought of sending Brodeur a note. Did he know that a particular statement in a particular paragraph of the great book had been undermined by this piece of research? Which I think would have intrigued him coming from a graduate student, and I would have at least been invited to go and call on him if I was in Paris. But maybe it was a good thing not to. I mean, he's a powerful intellectual presence at a distance. When I did meet him, I once interviewed him for the BBC, and afterwards I met him a few times. He's such a powerful personality that the danger would be of being taken over, becoming a Brodelian in a groupy sort of way. Just as I didn't want to be a Marxist, but I wanted to learn from Marx. I wanted to learn from Brodeur, but not be any kind of Brodelian or whatever. Trevor Roper was helpful there because of all British historians in 1960, he was probably the most openly sympathetic to Anarl, without ever belonging to the school or anything like that. So, for many years now, I've always tried to approach things at least by asking the big Brodelian questions, the things about connections. So total history, not in the sense that you've got absolutely every detail, but total history in the sense that you look at every domain of human behavior and you always ask if one of them has made an impact on all the others. And the long durée. So even if you're studying 10 or 50 years, always place it in the larger context. However big your topic, it could always be put in a still more global context. That's what I've learned from him. I've had fun teaching in the Cambridge supervision system, and for 1 week you give people an essay on the Ottoman Empire, and they write about the times when the Turks invaded Central Europe. But of course there are other times that the Turks didn't. And then you ask them, have they any explanation of why there were moments when a particular sultan is trying to capture Vienna or Belgrade and other times not? Is it just aggressive and unaggressive sultans, or wouldn't it be a good idea to look at the Ottoman Empire's eastern frontier? And we don't know so much about the history of Persia, but enough to know that sometimes the Turks were on the defensive. And then this, sometimes as a parting shot, I say, well, maybe one ought to know what's happening on the eastern frontier of the Persian Empire as well. These things can never be stopped. And would never have said that if it hadn't been for reading Brodeur.
Well, let's move on from Oxford now to Sussex. When did you go to Sussex and what was it like?
I'm very proud to be able to say that I went in 62. That is, I arrived while they were laying the dining hall floor. And we were in these prefabricated huts on the edge of the campus because the building wasn't on time. So there was the real sense that we were starting something, which was terribly exciting. And the sense, there is no tradition at this place. We are going to have to make a tradition now. That's also good for a historian. The second meeting of the School of European Studies, somebody already quoted the first meeting as a precedent, and I should have written it in a diary, but I remember thinking, you know, this is how historical traditions get created. And it was a great liberation. I mean, I applied for the job because I'd heard Asa Briggs talk about history and sociology at this series of Oxford lectures, and he'd happened to remark casually that all this kind of interdisciplinary thing, this is just what was going to be institutionalized at the university that was going to start in the following October. And so I actually wrote to him and said, are there going to be any jobs? And he sent me a postcard saying advertisements will be in 3 months' time. So I duly applied and got it, and there was this challenge to invent new courses, because all the people senior to me were trying to invent new courses, so they had no time to tell the assistant lecturers what to do. There were so many of us, age 25, straight from being graduate students and research fellows, and all allowed to do our own thing. And then the chances for collaboration on one side with sociology and on the other side with literature, also with philosophy if I wanted, were enormous, and I benefited to a very great degree. I would have been very happy to collaborate a bit with anthropology, but the first professor was Freddie Bailey. He caught me one day with Malinowski under my arm. I just got it out of the university library. And so he grinned and said, "You know, we anthropologists don't believe in that stuff anymore." which was a little bit of telling somebody no trespassing, I think, though he did it in a very nice way. And that you people won't understand that we've got our own development and so on. Whereas sociology, which I think that is the tradition, sociology is more like a city maybe, and anthropology more like a village or a tribe. Sociologists thought I could just as well teach sociology anybody else if I wanted. And of course Asa in particular, being a historian, thought that I could. And right from the first year I was teaching a course in sociological theory. That's how I learned it actually, week by week, reading the textbooks. And helped by the fact that Norman Birnbaum, in whose seminar I'd given this Oxford paper, he'd volunteered to write me an extra reference for the Sussex job, just to tell Asa that I'd given a paper about sociology. It might have been the reason. It must have been quite competitive, that job. I don't know who else was in for it. Maybe being given a fourth unsolicited reference was just the thing that made the difference. Anyway, the sense then that it was all permissible to invade other people's disciplines, that there were people that would welcome you into learning about theirs, that they would teach a joint seminar with you. It was wonderful to have that support when I was branching out in these ways. I'm equally grateful for the fact that Cambridge was the opposite when I arrived in 79, and it was like standing in the cold shower. I mean, you had to justify every borrowing from another discipline in the history faculty. Because by that time I'd got the confidence, but maybe I was getting a little uncritical of it. And so to be forced to justify to these people why I'd spent all this time reading books on written by people in other disciplines, that was quite good as well.
Were there any people in Cambridge, obviously Geoffrey Elton springs to mind, were there others who were forcing you to be explain
oh yes, especially when I and Bob Scribner, who was a very close colleague for a few years while he was in Cambridge, we set up this course called Historical Anthropology. And of course it had to go to the faculty board. And the faculty board kept sending it back. They would find some very trivial reason for sending it back, but it was happening too often. So of course we smelt a rat, and it was because Derek Beals was opposed on principle to it. So one year when he wasn't in the chair, the chairman simply asked me to come to the meeting to explain what I wanted to do with this new paper. And then Derek didn't say anything. It would be too embarrassing to have a confrontation like that. And then the faculty board sent me such a funny note that it was fine to do this course, I quote, "as long as there was no theory in it." So of course we said yes, and of course we took no notice, and it was a course that the students really loved, and it ran for 6 years, and I'm very happy that it went. So by the 80s, by that point in the 80s, although there was the opposition in the faculty, there were also other people who said, "Well, why don't you let them have a go? These are two trained historians, they're not going to be unhistorical. Maybe the students will find it fun." And those colleagues won.
Well, the other cold shower which afflicted you when you came to Cambridge was Emmanuel College.
Yes.
Can you say something about that?
That's right. And to be fair, it wasn't a colder shower than most colleges would have been. because it was and remains a very friendly place, but it was still a culture shock coming from Sussex, where everything was informal, and we had a kind of rather informal lifestyle, so much so, I'm not sure that I owned a tie in 1979. I know I'd got married in one, but I'm not sure whether I'd kept it, because I either wore open neck in the summer or polo neck in the winter. So I arrive in Emmanuel and I start dining, and I notice out of the corner of my eye that other people are wearing ties, but I don't object to other people wearing ties, so I thought no more about it. And to the credit of the college, nobody complains the whole term. And then there's this annual meeting of the parlour, which is a slightly larger group than the SCR. And they passed a resolution reaffirming the good old custom that gentlemen dining in the evening, brackets, clergy excepted, should wear ties. But we were all sent a copy of this. They didn't send anything specially to me. So I thought that was such a very gentle reminder that I was prepared to conform. Whereas if I'd been told you have to wear a tie, I might have reacted like Wittgenstein and given up dining, because he had this problem, I remember, with Trinity in the 1930s. But there were so many little customs that sometimes exasperating, but sometimes just fascinating, I started to take notes. And it was a way of coping with the culture shock, to pretend that I was the anthropologist and write everything in my notebook. And some younger colleagues knew I was doing it, and if somebody in the governing body said something very stupid, somebody might whisper in my ear, "Put it in your notebook." And I didn't really think more of this until in 82 there was a conference on art history in Italy, and there was Bourdieu working on art at that time, but also on higher education. And as soon as he heard I was from Cambridge, he had all these questions. He wanted to know, how does the university work? And in the course of all this, then I somehow found myself telling him, well, I'd got field notes on the college. And so he roared with laughter and he said, choose any name you like, I'll publish this in the Acte de la Recherche Sociale. So I took him very literally, and in about a week I just wrote an article and signed it William Dell and called it St. Dominic's, Notes Towards the Ethnography of a Cambridge College. And this was so that the real insiders would know what it was about, because Emmanuel, as you know, is on the site of the Dominican friars in Cambridge. And William Dell was once a fellow of Emmanuel who was asked to give the university sermon. He was a hero of Christopher Hill's, actually, who wrote an article about him, because he gave the university sermon in front of the vice-chancellor in full regalia against gowns, hoods, tippets, and such like anti-Christian forms and follies, also against the use of Latin in the university. Because he was a real radical Puritan of the kind that Oliver Cromwell and Christopher Hill loved. Actually, Cromwell took him out of Emmanuel and made him Master of Keys, and he was ejected in 1660 and went to a country living in Bedfordshire, and the first thing he did was ask John Bunyan, who of course was not in the Church of England, to preach from his pulpit. So right down to the end of his life, Dell liked doing unconventional things. So I thought that was a nice nom de plume. So there it is. It's had a great life as a samizdat, at least among graduate students. But Cambridge, like England in a sense, being so much a culture of the implicit, I cannot tell whether some of my conservative colleagues know about this or not. I suppose I shall never know.
Returning to another person who I know has influenced you a lot, how was it that you came across Raphael Samuel, and what influence has he had on your work?
Yes. Raph I met in Oxford in 64, when I'd gone back for a term, had a term's leave and was thinking of getting back to my PhD. And at that point, he was very interested in the history of religion and popular religion. And he was starting a series of graduate seminars. And there was Jill Thomas, not yet Jill Sutherland. And there was Gareth Stedman-Jones. And there was a very quiet young man who, as I remember, didn't say anything in the seminars, but he still came every week, Roderick Flood. And there might have been another couple of people, I've forgotten. And so we had a very informal series of seminars in which I talked about Jansenism. And, oh yes, and John Walsh came and talked about Methodism. And Raff about the 19th century and so on. And he's one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. And after Edward Thompson, the one that did most, I think, to give working class history in Britain a kind of epic quality. When he talks about it, it just sounds like the most important subject in the world. And then we kept up ever since. I mean, because in Sussex you couldn't do research, so I used to go twice a week to the British Museum, which was where the library still was, and kept bumping into Raff in the round reading room, and we would go out to lunch and talk and so on. That lasted years and years. He was a kind of elder brother figure because he was always encouraging me to do things. He wanted me to be more committed to the left, and he was always greeting me with fist clenched, though I'm afraid I never really got round to doing this in return. And then he used to organise these incredible Ruskin conferences, which by the early 70s, I remember somebody in The Guardian said, had the atmosphere of a small pop festival. And there was this one on childhood in history and children's liberation. And because I was interested in the ideas of Philip Arias, who was after all part of the Annal, and Raff knew this, he asked me to give this talk about, does childhood have a history and was it invented in France in the 17th century? What can it mean to say this? And I remember a couple of small children crawling onto the platform, and of course in such a atmosphere, nobody was ever going to pick them up. So I went on lecturing while surrounded by small children. And then there was another one about socialist history, which was very interesting. And at some point, I remember saying we had to kind of give our confession of faith. So I said I was a socialist and a historian, but I wasn't a socialist historian, because I didn't think history could be written from just one point of view. And an elderly trade unionist got up and said, "You mean we ought to write history from the boss's point of view?" and those seminars at Oxford, and then the big workshops, but above all, in this case, it was Raphael's personality, this one, and seeing history from below. And maybe I wouldn't have written that book on popular culture in the 70s if I hadn't become a great friend of Raff's in the 60s.
The other person who was very dynamic, certainly, and a great writer in the same league as yourself, was Roy Porter. Mm. Did you know Roy?
Whom I didn't meet till the late 70s when I was asked by actually Emmanuel History Society, when not knowing I was ever going to have a connection with that college. So they wanted me to give a talk on some very general subject, and I said history of mentalities is, should there be a history of mentalities? And so I give the talk, and then there is this youngish man with his shirt right open and his hair all over the place, and he asked the first question about what do I think about the relation to mentalities and ideology, and this turns into a kind of conversation rather than just me answering the question, and he seems very sympathique, and I get to talk to him, and that was Roy. And very few years later we started to collaborate, and I forget how many books we both contributed to. Even the ones we edited together add up to 3 or 4, let alone the ones we both contributed to. So I do think of him, he was about nearly 10 years younger than me, but very much pursuing within British history the kind of career I was trying to pursue for European.
Which perhaps takes us to two last questions I'd like to ask you. One is, If you had to summarize what you think the question behind your work, the major questions behind your work have been, what are you really seeking for?
Yeah.
It's a very difficult
yeah.
to summarize it, but in 2 or 3 minutes, could you outline that?
There are two very big problems I have been wrestling with all my life. And one is about how far there is a European history, that is, it's really how much there's a common culture for all those countries. And I mean, I never wanted to think of Europe as just Western Europe. And I suppose it's really for one psychoanalyst to answer this rather than oneself. But I've got to think of it as trying to bring my two pairs of grandparents together, since they come from the western and eastern edges of Europe, and so in some sense I do, and therefore to be a whole person I have to try to look at Europe as a whole. But then the other question that emerged relatively early for me was the history and theory one. What has, surely if sociologists, anthropologists, and later I started to think geographers and political scientists have got insights into human behavior, they must be relevant to history. If they're true, we've got to use them. And maybe the best way of testing them is going to be to try to use them in history, because almost all the social science concepts are coined in a context which is that of the present, somewhere or other. So if you take them back a couple of centuries, you're always asking, is this a key that only fits one particular lock, or is it some kind of master key that might open more locks? So I do think that historians have got quite a useful function, even though we steal so many concepts from our colleagues in the social sciences, we give them so very few concepts in return. The one thing that we can do is always this testing in a new set of circumstances, which is quite a harsh but quite a valuable test for any concept to go through. So I suppose those are the two big things which I've been trying to do through doing smaller things all my working life.
Lovely. And the last question is really, recently you've married a Brazilian. If you sit back. I just wondered whether you wanted to say anything about Maria and about Brazil, which you're going off to after you retire.
It's hard to make it a short question. I suppose, again, trying to stand outside and look at myself from outside. Mm. I've always been drawn to Latin cultures. I was very excited to start working on Italy by doing an Italian Renaissance special subject when I was an undergraduate. I mean, I took to the country instantly, and then to Spain. And then when somebody arrived in my college to invite me to lecture in Brazil, I both found that individual captivating and was deeply attracted by the idea of getting to know Brazil. And that was Maria Lúcia, whom I happened to meet on Emmanuel soil, because she came with this message, would I give a course of lectures in São Paulo? And so discovering her and discovering São Paulo and discovering Brazil have all got mixed up together. It's an unending thing, this discovery. And I remember trying to see Brazil as a kind of Italy. I mean, an enormous and even more chaotic sort of Italy, and seeing that in some ways this didn't work. And then, of course, discovering that Maria Lúcia's family is about as culturally mixed as mine, because she's Spanish on one side, Italian on the other, yet speaks Portuguese, which is very typical Brazilian sort of thing. So between us, we are quite a mixture. I mean, so her parents were migrants, my grandparents were migrants. And in Brazil, they take it for granted that everybody's a migrant. And the first question they ask you, where you're from, then if you say Britain, and they say, and where's your family from? The absolute assumption that it's going to be somewhere else. I find this very refreshing. And thanks to Singapore, and thanks to Italy, I was already adjusted to the idea that the apparent rules may not be the real rules, or as Brazilians love to put it, the distance between the legal country, the país Legal, and the real place, the Pais Real, it can be quite a big distance.
Well, I think on that nice Brazilian note, we sadly ought to end, but I want to thank you very much indeed, Peter. Yeah. Interviewing you, I almost felt I was at times interviewing myself.
Many right.
Our experiences and interests and ways of looking at things are so very similar. It was a particular pleasure. So thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you for giving me the chance.